Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. As anyone who has been profoundly depressed can tell you, under its influence, everything is painted with a bleak and hopeless brush. The same neighborhood strolled in a happy mood changes into a sad, dirty, and even dangerous neighborhood under the veil of depression. Modern psychology identifies early traumatic experiences as a major root cause of depression and anxiety. Childhood experiences form the way we adapt or maladapt toward the world. How we cope with the world as adults is informed by the subtext of our childhood. Our capacity or lack of capacity for self-esteem, self-nurturance, and self-protection may be buried deeply in the parts of our brain that remain immature. Today's guest, psychiatrist and author Dr. Frederick Schiffer, discusses dual brain psychology and new research that supports his hypothesis that we have both an immature and a mature aspect to our personalities that can be accessed separately to promote dialogue, integration, and eventually healing. Frederick Schiffer, MD, Dr. Frederick Schiffer, is an assistant clinical professor in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School at McLean Hospital and maintains a clinical practice in Newton, Massachusetts. Dr. Schiffer's theoretical integration of psychotherapy and neuroscience is as described in his book, Of Two Minds, The Revolutionary Science of Dual Brain Psychology, as well as in his scientific publications, and suggests that we are literally of two minds, each associated with one of the two sides of the brain. Recent experimental evidence, as I said, from another Harvard Medical Center gives strong support for his hypothesis, and that's what we'll be talking about eventually in this interview. Welcome to you, Dr. Schiffer. Are you with us?
Yes.
Ah, welcome to you. I wonder if I could start by being a little provocative. I already know what your feelings are about this, but I'll ask you, do you believe that the psychological conditions of depression, anxiety, addiction, and psychosis, do you believe them to be separate?
I think that they're actually from a similar base. I think that they're all attempts to deal with traumas, either attempts to deal with it or the effects of old traumas. So I think that they're interrelated, but some people might wind up dealing with their problems by using substances. Someone else might wind up getting into psychosis, and someone else may wind up tormenting themselves and getting depressed. So I think that their manifestations are different, but I think the root causes bear a relationship to each other.
It strikes me that in the evolution of a troubled personality from childhood adaptations, that one of the things that's particularly sad about this kind of a condition is that part of what's so magical about being human is the ability to sort of dream yourself into being as you're evolving, to be able to daydream or imagine yourself into being in a positive
mm-hmm.
way.
Right.
And when that's interfered with by a child having to adapt to a difficult situation in childhood, is there something very pernicious about what happens? Do you want to explain?
Well, I think that when a child is abused, and abuse is a term that we're expanding on, that it used to mean some life-threatening condition, but we know now that abuse can be neglect, rejections, bullying, that there's a whole range of things that injure people. And one of the ways in which people who were abused as children try to cope is to withdraw it into fantasies and to pretend that it's not happening. And this often, I think, leads to dissociations in adulthood, which are sort of like hypnotic states. So I think there's a difference between a person who's had a well-nurtured life, going on vacation and getting into creative mode and having fantasies or doing creative writing, and someone who's a child trapped in a very abusive environment, and their only escape is to pretend it's not happening.
Yeah. As you said, that's disassociative, and what that does is have that type of personality, as it evolves, is going to have an interesting or difficult time in relationship to other people. So there's a rather strong effect on the ability to have relationships. There's, I think, among people raised in an environment that causes them to be somewhat disassociative or to escape or run away if they're in pain, is that they tend to isolate and self-punish.
Yes, and also I think that we're talking about something that I think happens to everybody to different degrees.
Yes.
And at different times, and depending on whether someone is actually being tortured as a child, or whether it's more of an ordinary rejection that's painful. The ways in which we cope with the painful things that happen to us shape us, but we're constantly reshaping ourselves as we grow and develop and think about ourselves.
Well, and you in fact are in this environment where even regular doctors are advocating for psychiatric medications, and people are seeing ads on TV now, so, you know, with people squeezing their faces and saying, you know, you don't have to feel like this, you know, you can take this medication.
Mm-hmm.
You are a great proponent of therapy as a means of reintegrating and healing persistent personality disorders. And so I'm guessing that whatever effects trauma has on the brain, even if they are biochemical in nature, what your tendency is to look more at using a therapeutic model rather than looking at the success of medication and this other theory of it's all biochemistry and genetics.
Well, I do practice psychotherapy. I also use medications in my practice, but my emphasis is on psychotherapy, and I think that there's a relationship, certainly, between the brain and the mind, and I think it works both ways. I think whenever we're upset, we're affecting our brain, and it may be that if we're upset for a long period of time, that we have actual brain changes that occur. But an interesting observation is that very often a patient can come into a session very depressed, and by the end of the session leave feeling well, and that's not enough time for a hardwired brain to change. So I think that a lot of the changes that occur in the brain are plastic and are recoverable. But then again, therapy often takes a long time, and so there may be other brain changes that are more stuck in there, or can have temporary improvements and then revert back. And it's kind of therapy, in my mind, is kind of like helping a child. And if a child's been traumatized, you sit with the child and you try and comfort the child and teach the child that they're safer than they were in their experience, in their traumatizing experience. And you'll get the child to agree with you that he's safer, and he'll say, uh-huh, and then there'll be a loud noise, and the child kind of reverts back to his traumatized state. And this is very much what therapy is like. And And I think it's hard to separate, where the brain ends and the mind begins and vice versa. But there is an interesting thing that there was a headline last week that there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and the headline was that St. John's wort didn't do any better than placebo in an eight-week study of people with depression. And what wasn't in the headline was that Zoloft was also included in the study, so that there was actually a comparison between Zoloft, St. John's wort, and placebo, and they all did about the same. And I think that there's a lot of literature showing that the antidepressants in particular aren't as effective as are popularly believed. And I think the ad where somebody's squeezing their face and if they would only take a pill, they'd be fine, I think is an exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I say, I do prescribe medications in my practice. I'm not against them. But I think that, in general, I think they're overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that therapy is a more powerful intervention.
Well, and to that end, I want to get into the material that you initially wrote your book of Two Minds
mm-hmm.
about, the revolutionary science of dual brain psychology. Let me do an early identification of the show so I don't have to interrupt you after I ask you a question, but it's Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm speaking with Dr. Frederick, spelled F-R-E-D-R-I-C, Schiffer, and it's S-C-H. IFFERMD, and his book of Two Minds is published by Free Press. What got you interested, I think, in the idea that there might be a separate, that you could actually separate on in therapy these two aspects of the brain, and that they might be different in terms of which aspect is wounded the most. Did you want to get into this by talking a bit about early dual brain research and maybe epilepsy?
Yes. Why don't I do that? And then I can talk about the recent study that adds more support for the hypothesis, and actually very strong support in the new research. And the theory began just with an observation in my work with psychotherapy patients, that there seemed to be not so much ids and superegos and interjects and Oedipal complexes and things of that sort that I had been taught about, but it seemed that there was kind of an immature part of a person and a more mature part. And if a person was afraid of going on an airplane, there was an old trauma that an intelligent, immature part of him was reasoning that it was in fact dangerous to be on an airplane, and that this is consistent with traditional Freudian psychology. That we have an unconscious and unconscious motivations. What I was seeing was that in fact it was not only an unconscious, but that there was a whole personality there, and that sometimes the immature personality would dominate a person, and so that the immature part of the person might be most of what you saw, and occasionally you might see the mature part, or I might see a switch between an immature person and a mature person, that maybe one day this individual is able to get on an airplane or have relationships, and then other times he can't. And then I got interested in the split brain studies, and what these showed was. That the brain has two halves, as we all know, the left brain and the right brain. And in patients with epilepsy, as a treatment, the connection between the two halves was cut. And the surprising thing from this research was that each half of the brain had an intact mind, and that you could actually interview each half of the brain. Some people feel that the right hemisphere in these patients wasn't very intelligent, but we found, and Spurry's group found, that the right hemisphere was very intelligent, as was the left hemisphere. And I went out to California at UCLA and did a study on two split brain patients and did a psychiatric interview where we had different words projected on two sides of a computer screen. And I'd ask a question like, how much do you feel? And one side might say honest and the other side might say depressed. And so we would rotate the questions so that each word went to both sides of the screen, and each hemisphere could watch only half the opposite half of the screen. So we could, in effect, interview separately and simultaneously each half of the brain.
Let me just ask you two questions. One you can back burner if you'd like, which is how this relates to multiple personality disorder, you know, the psychosis where people escape into numerous personalities rather than just two. Do you want to?
I think that multiple personality disorder might actually be similar to kind of a dual personality disorder, where what you really see in multiples. And these people all are trauma victims. I don't think that there's any multiple personality disordered person who didn't go through severe trauma. What you usually find is that they're mature personalities and immature personalities. And so in a certain way, I think that it's more that they're the same two sides that I'm seeing.
Broken up,
yeah. And that, but the major division is between mature and immature personalities, and I'll talk in a minute about glasses that I've developed
to separate the
personalities in ordinary people, and a colleague of mine in New Jersey has a practice where he has about 10 patients with multiple personality disorders, and he's found that he can divide the mature and immature personalities with these glasses that I've developed, and that they all wind up being on one side or the other.
One other question. Am I stopping you in the middle of a thought?
No.
Okay. One of the disadvantages of not having you sit across from me. How does this relate to the research that people will more commonly be aware of in terms of different sides of the brain, which is the left and right brain styles? You know, the, I believe, right brain is the more intuitive. It's reversed
right.
from what you
well,
think.
I think.
The right side of the body is the left brain, which is intuitive, something like that.
Well, there are a lot of different things that are localized in different sides of the brain. For instance, there's a motor strip and a sensory strip in each half of the brain, and the motor strip in the left brain controls the right side of the body.
That's right, and that's the more dominant, not the more intuitive, the more structured side, more analytical.
Well, actually, that's the conventional wisdom that the left brain is more logical, and the right brain is kind of more poetic or more intuitive, and I think that there may be something to that, but it's actually very difficult to sort out, and science hasn't kept up with the conventional wisdom on that question. So I think that there are hints that may in fact be true, and there seems to be some truth to that. What I'm focusing on is actually a kind of a higher order than that, and that is that if I go back to the split brain study in California that I was doing, one of the patients had been bullied as a child, and I asked him if he were upset by it, and he told me he wasn't. And these patients were able to answer my questions with their hands, and his right hand would answer for his left brain, and his speaking brain was his left brain, and his right hand confirmed what he told me, that he wasn't upset about the bullying. But his left hand was talking for his right brain, and it indicated that he was extremely upset by the bullies, and there were 14 questions about the bullies. And what we concluded, and we had ways of verifying that we were getting answers from each hemisphere, like we would ask whether they liked paying taxes or not. We had questions like that, and so we could verify that we were getting questions from each side. And what we found was that the patient's left brain wasn't upset by the bullies, as he told me, but that his right brain was still extremely upset by the bullies, even though it had happened 35 years ago. And this is the model that I've been going with, that each hemisphere can support a whole mind, and that these minds may have different views on the world, and one view may be stuck in the past and in past traumas. And I was reading one day about a group of German scientists who were purporting to show movies to one hemisphere or the other in intact people. And this I thought was impossible because of the connection between the two halves of the brain that exists in healthy people. And what they were doing was they had elaborate mechanisms for tracking eye movements and masking a computer screen, but what they were really doing was just showing the film to one side of the person, one extreme side. And it turns out that that image then goes primarily to the other side. So I decided from that to have people cover their eyes so that they only could see out the lateral half of one eye. And it turns out that there's a large literature showing that if you have people do a verbal task and you put the information to their right side, that they'll do it better than if you put the information to their left side, because the right side goes to the left brain, and the left brain is better at verbal tasks. And it also turns out that you can stimulate one half of the brain or the other very easily. Either you can squeeze a ball in one hand or the other. If you squeeze it in the right hand, you can do a verbal task better than if you squeeze it in the left hand. And again, you're activating the left hemisphere. Well, with these glasses that I used, which were simply just letting light in one half in the lateral side of one eye, I call it lateral visual stimulation, I got dramatic personality changes in my psychotherapy patients, in about 30% of them.
Is there a difference for you in what you saw in your patients? Is there a difference in gender differences? Do you see, because we live in a patriarchal society, so I wonder how different it would be for women versus men. Is it not so different?
Well, I'm not sure. When I analyze the data, I don't see great differences in most of the studies, but it seems to me in my clinical practice that there are a group of men with in my practice, kind of in their middle 30s to middle 40s, who had fathers who were very humiliating and usually verbally abusive, sometimes physically abusive, not to the point of being illegal or anything, but kind of hitting the kid on the head a lot and telling him he's worthless, and that these people tend to have very strong responses to the goggles. Women who respond to them don't seem to respond as much as this group of men. So I would say that men seem to who respond seem to have more intense responses than women in general, but there are exceptions to that, and many women in my practice respond to the glasses.
Well, and this is not to say that if you don't have a specific split, that if you don't experience the world differently covering one of your eyes, that you don't still have an immature and mature parts of your psychology
absolutely.
That need to dialogue. They still need to be accessed, and they still need to be a dialogue between the two sides and development of the mature side. But what made me ask about the gender differences is because what we see so markedly in our society is a problem with men accessing their feelings, even when they try, even when they want to, because men are held to such a high standard of performance all the time that they tend to have a very difficult time allowing any part of themselves to be immature or to have a voice from that vulnerable part. So it makes them very split in half in a way.
What the kind of things that I'll see with the glasses are a person may look at one side and say, I had a patient last night who tried the glasses for the first time, and he looked at one side and he said, I can't stand myself. I'm worthless. I'd like to kill myself. And he looked at the other side and he said, no, I'm okay. I don't think I'm terrific, but I'm okay. And these kind of extreme differences are what I've focused on in my book, and have transcripts of tape recordings of the sessions with patients when they were wearing these glasses, and they're also demonstrated on 2020 with Tim Johnson, and mm-hmm. and so when you see these, they're really remarkable, and it isn't blocking one eye or the other. It's actually one half. It's looking out of one half of one eye, looking out because actually each eye goes to both brains. And it's not that if you look out one half of one eye that it only goes to the opposite brain, but it tends to activate the opposite hemisphere. And we believe that because there's a large literature supporting that. And also we've done and published EEG studies showing activation. And we are currently doing blood flow studies at McLean Hospital.
Yeah.
And then we have the study that was recently published.
But before we go to that, I need to take a very brief break.
Sure.
And also I want to caution people that during the break, you know, don't run out to the mirror and cover. The reason I'm saying that is because actually if people are not prepared for it, that you can have a strong reaction. So We'd like to talk more about it before you try this.
Sure.
So this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I am interviewing Dr. Frederick Schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, M-D. His book is called Of Two Minds, and it's published by Free Press. We will be back in about 35 seconds with some more of this interview, so stay with us. Phone with Dr. Frederick Schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, M-D. You can get his book Of Two Minds, but you can also, if you want, look at his website, and I believe it is Schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, M-D, one word, no periods, www.schiffermd.com, is it not?
Yes,
okay.
That's correct.
Yeah, so you can go to his website, and actually his website has some interesting, this is where I was reading some of your opinions about medication and stuff, where you're a little more anti-med when you cut loose on your website. But we were just talking about the research that you've done in your own clinical practice using these goggles, and I mentioned, before we go to this new research, I just mentioned that maybe people wouldn't want to just on the break run out and do this to, you know, cover everything except half of one eye, the lateral half, the outer side of one eye. And why would that be a good thing to wait and do? Because, I mean, I think I remember reading your book, and some people have a strong reaction. They get very depressed or... If you're uncomfortable, you can stop.
You can just stop,
yeah. Yeah,
and it'll subside. You can look out the other side. And also, the people who have the strongest responses are people who have severe traumas or severe depressions. And so I think that in a general population, I think about 20% of people will probably feel a strong response, and maybe I would expect about half of the people would feel some difference between the two sides, and about half the people probably won't notice any difference.
And what is the percentage in your practice, loosely, of the people who seem to get better with this using the glasses? And we'll get into some of the other.
Well, I think one of the things that I want to say is that the glasses aren't a therapy.
No, I understand.
And that I use them in psychotherapy, and it's a traditional psychotherapy. And it's very hard to objectively measure you know how much they help. I have an impression that the people who respond to the glasses seem to have the best outcomes in my practice, and I think that it's because being able to look out one side or the other and have such different perceptions makes you think, and sometimes when you have a person who has a very low self-esteem or feels a high level of anxiety, and if they can with their own eyes look out the other side and for the first time feel good about themselves with their own eyes rather than my telling them that you know that I value them, if they can value themselves, that's very compelling and very helpful in therapy.
Well, it sets up a dialogue between the two aspects of the personality.
Yes, yes, yeah. It is. Exactly.
Yeah.
And quite often, one of the problems has been that there hasn't been a dialogue, and that the you know these aspects you know don't know of each other's existence.
Right. But this is again also true in people who don't have necessarily this visual split, or
that's
this,
right. That's
because
right.
This is the dilemma in psychology and therapy in general, whether it's just counseling or whatever it is, you're still going to have to find the inner observer that has a mature and non-judgmental, non-dualistic, you excuse the pun.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that I think that the work with the goggles has overshadowed what I feel is the most important part of my work, which is conceptualize psychotherapy as the treatment of the troubled personality, or the troubles that we have, I think, are integrated and make sense from the point of view of the child that we were, and from the perspective of the traumas that we went through, and the therapy becomes teaching that immature part that it's now safe and valued as something that it wasn't before at the time of the trauma.
Well, and I want to go to the new research, but just to finish what we're talking mm-hmm. about here, I think also, is it not important when uncovering the causes and effects of trauma to avoid, if possible, re-traumatizing the patient? I mean, it's hard to know exactly what to do here, because sometimes it seems important to access important traumatic experiences to have the patient go back and have some experience of it again in the safety of the therapist's office, but certainly not before, as you say, creating a strong container and strengthening mm-hmm. the mature voice first. So I think one of the maybe one of the reasons that people use medication with therapy is that you want to somehow strengthen, if for lack of a better way of saying it, the container or the ego, literally, of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
People always think you're supposed to get rid of your ego. This is a misunderstanding, I think. But you create a strong ego so that when you have a traumatized, when you revisit a traumatic area, you have this sense of safety. Does that sound right?
Yeah, and I would say that what I call the mature part of or the mature side would be the ego. You know we traditionally would refer to as the ego, that meaning a more mature side, and not necessarily just cognitive part of our personality or function.
It may not just be discursive. It may be the part that functions well in the world.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that part, what I try to do is to help people to be enable that part to sit with the troubled part and to kind of be a good parent to themselves.
So on to the new research, which validates your hypothesis.
Well, there's a treatment for depression called transcranial magnetic stimulation, and what it does is it activates as it's used the left hemisphere, and essentially it's an electromagnet that's placed over the left forehead. And it causes a small amount of current in the front of the brain. And the patient goes in for a half-hour treatment 5 days a week for 2 weeks. And it's painless, and it's not like electroshock therapy or something where there's convulsion or there's pain involved or anesthesia necessary. This is essentially a painless technique. And about 50% of the patients who have this treatment seem to get some benefit from it. And so I called a researcher who does this work at another Harvard hospital, and I suggested to him that I might be able to predict which of his patients, which of the 50% of his patients are going to be the ones who are going to respond to the treatment that he's giving. And what I was thinking was this, that if in fact each hemisphere is associated with a healthier side and a more troubled side, that one of the things that I hadn't mentioned in the program here was that one of the things that I had initially thought was that all the troubled sides were going to be in the right brain. And it turned out not to be the case. It turned out that in the majority of depressed people, about 60-65% of the time, it was in the right brain, but that in people with post-traumatic stress disorder, it seemed to be more in the left brain. And that it was hard to know which side in an individual they were going to feel better looking out the left or the right side. So my thought was that if somebody had a healthy, had their more mature side in their left brain and you were activating it, this should help their depression. But if you're activating a troubled hemisphere, they probably won't get better. And so the researcher, Alvaro Pasqualeone, at Beth Israel Hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, he decided to try my glasses on 37 profoundly depressed patients who had been through many forms of treatment for depression. Also, they had to have failed 3 medication trials. Many of them, I think most of them, had hospitalizations and shock treatment. So they were people who had profound depression histories. And he had 2 pairs of glasses, and he would put on the glasses and ask them if their depression were the same, or if their depression felt better or worse, and they would rate it if it felt better from 1 to 5, and worse -1 to -5. And these responses occur very quickly in both in my experience and his experience. And so within 45 seconds, he would ask after 45 seconds, he would ask the patient how they felt, and they would give a response. And it turns out that of the 37 patients, they all had responses to the glasses. And actually, 2 of them had the same response. But otherwise, the other 35 felt better looking one way or the other. And 20 of the patients felt better when they looked to the right, meaning that their left brain should be the healthier side. This group did very well with the magnetic treatment, and And 2 weeks after their two-week course of treatment, their depression was improved.
Okay, Fred, before they had the big walk.
Hello.
Are you still there?
I'm
okay.
here.
Okay, are you there, Diane?
Hello.
It sounds like somebody's broken into our show. Okay, I think we have you still there, Dr.
I'm here.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Sure.
You were talking about the magnetic.
Right. The 20 people who felt better when they looked to the right had their depression improved 43%, which is a very impressive response. Those who felt worse when they looked to the right and better when they looked to the left, they only had an 11% improvement, and that's considered a treatment failure. Below 20% is considered a treatment failure. So there was really a 400% difference between the two groups. And it was in the direction that I had predicted, that those people who seemed to feel better in their left brain had a positive response to transcranial magnetic stimulation. And so I felt that this was supportive of my hypothesis.
You know, people have been hearing about the dangers of electromagnetic radiation. Is this different than exposing them to?
I'm not expert at that. I really can't answer that.
Right.
I would say that when you have profound depression of that magnitude,
it might be
like
worth
cancer,
an exposure. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you're willing to take a radiation or chemotherapy or things that
may cause another cancer. Yeah.
Yeah, that may be dangerous, but yeah. But in the circumstance, you're willing.
Well, and it's a short exposure time too. It's
that's
not,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also it's probably a different type of radiation, although I can't speak to that.
Yeah, I understand. I want to go back for a moment to the early research that was done on dual brain research using the epileptic model, because I wonder why there aren't treatment plans that are related to what we've discovered about that. I mean, that you can turn, isn't it the case that you can turn off the epilepsy by referring to one side of the brain versus the other or something?
No.
What
the surgery was intended to do was to prevent the epilepsy from spreading to the other side and kind of limiting it to one side. So it was helpful in that regard, but it didn't stop the seizure focus.
No, that's too bad. So it wasn't useful for that, unfortunately.
Well, it did help the patients with the epilepsy because it didn't become a full-blown seizure. And there still are, it still is a procedure that's done on a more limited basis. To my knowledge, I don't think full split-brain operations are done, but they're partial. It's called colostotomy. Partial colostotomies that are done today. And again, I can't speak with authority about the therapeutic efficacy of it for epilepsy.
I just want to remind people again that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm interviewing Dr. Frederick, and it's spelled F-R-E-D-R-I-C, Frederick Schiffer, S-H. I'm sorry, S-C-H, forgive me. S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, Schiffer, M-D. His book is called Of Two Minds, The Revolutionary Science of Dual Brain Psychology. It's published by Free Press, and his website is www.schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R-M-D.com. No periods, all one word. And I was remiss in mentioning that if you want to get a cassette copy of today's show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can always go to my information numbers 24 hours a day, 707-874-2772 to get information, or you can go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com to figure out how to order tapes. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't speak to another side to all of this. I mean, I'm so aware of the fact that we're really in the infancy of uncovering what it is that occurs in the brain and what the consequences and benefits are of different substances and different activities and therapy and how it gets wounded and how much it is a part of everything else that goes on in the body, you know, because the neurotransmitters in the brain are things that communicate with cells, and those are, again, often nutrients. So the fact that medications have an effect in the brain means that nutrients, of course, do as well, since many medications are imitations of active ingredients from natural substances that have been isolated. I've done several shows with people who have done research into that, and the recent show that I did with Bernard Rimland, R-I-M-L-A-N-D, Rimland, PhD, who has discovered that substances like very, very, very high doses of B6 given with magnesium to avoid paresthesia has pulled about 50% of autistic children out of their autistic state. Substances like a dimethylglycine, a B-like vitamin, which is actually made from glycine, which is an amino acid that's all over the place in our world. And I'm trying to remember the third. There's been several. Secretin, the one of the digestive enzymes. Anyway, there have been these instances where you're able to introduce a substance and have a remarkable effect on brain chemistry. So it's a very spooky kind of thing. So I guess I want to just sort of remind people that there's very hard research on using omega-3 fatty acids, which are, again, found in fish and oils like flaxseed and hemp seed, and that the balance of those fats in the diet with the omega-6 fats, which are sort of ubiquitous because they're in grains and in nuts and things like that, so we eat them all the time, that nice balance of getting lots of the omega-3s in, and that people with personality disorders and psychiatric symptoms often they have a deficiency of omega-3s even and need to take even more. So actually taking capsules of fish oil or adding in these other oils is very important, as is a good nutrient-dense diet plus, at the very least, a multiple vitamin, unless there's a substance that we know, if in an extreme case of personality disorder, psychiatric symptoms, occasionally certain substances will be provocative. But for most people, a regular dose multivitamin will not be provocative and should be used because of the added effects of the protection of vitamin C, at least 1,000 milligrams with each meal, the B vitamins, enough of those to maintain and support somebody in stress, somebody who is having a stressful situation, or even B5, which is pantothenic acid, 500 milligrams extra with each meal to support the adrenal cortex. And then, of course, as you point out, I think in some point in the book too, this isn't to say that it's a simple situation, because hormone imbalances, the endocrine system, the thyroid, are all very important as well. I see a lot of depression in men with low testosterone, women with imbalances of their sex hormones. You know, so all of that matters a lot too, I think. Dr. Schiffer, with this issue of using medications, when you're dealing with someone who has an extreme, well, maybe extreme isn't right, but someone maybe who benefits from the goggles, someone who has a very clear split mm-hmm. in the brain, do medications tend to work better, worse, temporarily work? What's your experience with that? You're using it as a vehicle to make it easier to have a therapeutic relationship with somebody, I think.
Well, I have to say, you know, that I'm not greatly impressed with most medications. I think that the with the exception of the benzodiazepines like Valium or Klonopin,
the old ones.
Well, they're old drugs, but they're drugs that if you take them, you get a clear response, and you can be pretty sure that you've had a response to the drug. It's like if you drank a glass of wine. I mean, you can feel that you had an effect from a glass of wine, and you can be So the effect is so strong that there's no question that the drug had an effect.
Although they've been implicated in a number of sort of not so nice other effects.
I'm not advocating any of those drugs, but I'm saying that you can tell that they have some impact on mental processes. I think with the antidepressants and I think probably also with the antipsychotics, although with my practice today I'm dealing, I have more of a suburban practice today. So I'm not using as many antipsychotic medications, but with the antidepressants, it's very hard to tell whether you're getting a response or you're not getting a response, or whether they're placebo effects, and there are, I would say, about 20% of patients who seem to get very clear responses and beneficial responses from the antidepressants. I think that that's separate from whether they respond to the goggles or don't. Or
yeah, I get it. Yeah, there are people who feel very strongly that, for instance, when you're dealing with psychosis, like for instance, in a situation where somebody's hearing voices when they're a schizophrenic, that actually therapy does help with psychosis and schizophrenia, and it's often an ignored therapy is often ignored.
Absolutely, I think that therapy with major mental illness is very important, and when I was doing a lot of work at McLean Hospital and with inpatients, I thought that long-term psychotherapy with patients with major mental illness was extremely helpful, and at times could pull someone out of their condition. Actually, not infrequently. What would also happen was that someone would get better, and then they'd relapse, and they'd get better again, and then they'd relapse, and then it would be a difficult struggle for a long time. But I felt that it was very important, and there was a study done at McLean that kind of contributed to kind of the death knell of psychotherapy for particularly for schizophrenia, but I think for any psychosis. And I spent a year and a half reviewing that study and found it to be completely useless and filled with flaws. But unfortunately, politically, it put an end to the idea that psychotherapy could help people with major psychosis. But with my own experience, I think that's a crime.
There's also very early research that nutrients also help with schizophrenia. Abram Hoffer, who is a very eminent researcher who's still actually practicing in his 80s, did early research using niacin. And getting a good effect. And there actually is a pretty good book out there that chronicles all of the orthomolecular research on vitamins and dealing with psychiatric disorders. It's called Natural Healing for Schizophrenia. The author is Eva Edelman. It's E-D-E-L, I believe, M-A-N. I may be reversing the L in the E. It might be E-D-L-E. No, I think it's E-L-M-A-N. And her website is Borage, B-O-R-A-G-E, like the oil, boragebooks.com. And she's self-published, so that's available through her. I believe this very strongly, that the combination of intervention with therapy and nutrient changes can have a profound, at least equal effect to psychiatric medications. One last thing I was thinking about asking you is that there are many rungs on the psychotherapeutic ladder. There's many different styles of therapeutic intervention. There are psychologists, there are psychotherapists like you who do, they're very specific models and styles. And there's also, in my observation, a place for kind of supportive shall we say, emotional counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Not with a psychotic situation, but with some individuals find that they go to a psychotherapist.
Actually, it might be good for a psychotic situation, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people with psychoses can't tolerate, you know, probing into, you know, the depths of their psychosis, of their psyche, and
so they do better with cognitive therapy,
or
emotional support.
Supportive, yeah.
Yeah, because you know, one of the things that I find is that some people who come to me want to look into their psychological situation, but they, as you say, do not want to do this heavy mining and digging and mm-hmm. re-traumatizing that very in-depth psychotherapy will do. And some people will benefit from that kind of supportive counseling.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a whole range of things that people can benefit from. But one thing I think anyone who's suffered with any kind of invasive psychiatric symptom or even just real bouts of blueness might find the book of Two Minds very, very interesting to read, The Revolutionary Science of Dual Brain Psychology. Again, the author, Frederick Schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, M-D, and his website, schiffermd.com. And you can read some more articles by him, including the article on this new research. You've been very generous to spend this much time with us on the air. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Schiffer.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. And thanks, all of you, for listening to today's show. A reminder, I'm Lena Berman, and if you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. That's 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, go to the website. It also has information on ordering tapes and various other things. It's www.yourownhealthandfitness.com and is spelled out, yourownhealthandfitness.com. I do not have transcripts of shows, just tapes. Next week, I'll be back with a show about alternatives to dangerous residential pesticides. Arthur Slater is an expert from UC Berkeley who will discuss non-toxic alternative approaches to residential pest management. And this includes getting rid of animals, too. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness at the Sebastopol side at the Powerhouse Brewery is George Curtis, thanks to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse. And at KPFA, it's Lisa Ballard. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced live by Free Speech, May It Live Forever, KPFA Radio 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California. And I'll be back next week.